1000-watt News Radio 1180 WHAM proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show at 222-1180, star 1180, a free call for Verizon Wireless subscribers, or the One Communications line at 1-800-295-1180. Now alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on 50,000-watt 1180 WHAM.
Good morning, Mr. and Mrs. America, all the chips in the PC. It is Sunday, the 7th of January, Anno Domini 2007, and you lucky people, it's the first show of 2007 for us, and you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dan Cole.
And we'll be bringing you news, views, and stuff you can use. We'll start out with Microsoft. As you know, Microsoft's monthly visitor is coming up this Tuesday, and Microsoft has pulled four of the bulletins from its announced list of Patch Tuesday fixes, but did not specify why it was backpedaling on the security releases. It originally was going to announce, it had announced that it was going to put out eight patches. It has now reduced that to four. Three of those patches will contain fixes for Office, at least one of which will be rated critical. Critical vulnerabilities typically can allow a worm to spread or allow a Windows system to be fully compromised with minor or no interaction from the person using it. The fourth bulletin for Windows itself is also tagged critical. Now, last Thursday, Microsoft had listed eight bulletins that intended to issue next week in its monthly patch cycle. It appears to have pulled two bulletins for Windows, one for Windows and Visual Studio, and one for Windows and Office. These patches will likely be released on a future Patch Tuesday. There was no explanation for pulling the bulletins only a few days before their scheduled release. The company does not specify ahead of time which security vulnerabilities are addressed by its patches, and as a result, it's unknown what security holes will now be left for an entire month without a fix. So those of you using Windows, it's time to be super extra, truly magnificently cautious as you wander around the internet or open your email. I don't know.
More super extra cautious than we have been?
Yes, even more super extra cautious than we have been. Now, this we got, I want to thank Steve Lopiano, or Lopiano. I don't know how he pronounces that. I'm Italian. I would pronounce it Lopiano.
Could be Irish.
Could be Irish. He gave us he sent us a Christmas card, which I thought was very, very nice of him.
One Christmas card.
He apparently made it himself. Corel Painter 9, Art Rage 2, Broderbund Print Shop Deluxe 20.
Quite a job.
Broderbund just keeps on keeping on, doesn't it? Thank you very much, Stephen. We very much appreciate that, and we love to see those things. Thank you. All right, we should probably just go right to the phone now. Our first caller of 2007 is Larry from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Larry. And your absolutely non-existent prize. I can't use no prize. It's probably copyrighted by Marvel. But your non-existent prize will be in the non-existent mail eventually.
Well, I'll be happy not to receive it.
What's your question?
Well, for Christmas, I went out there on Black Friday, and I got a great deal on a new 22-inch monitor.
Nice.
By Westinghouse, and I hooked it up and everything, and I'm an old cat with Windows 98, and I won't play the Microsoft game and buy upgrade, and I was wondering, when I go online, my window is sized right for online purposes, but everything else that I look at off my computer, like any documents and everything, are all stretched, you know, all my picture programs and everything. And I went to the display, and I tried changing the 840 by whatever.
Is this a widescreen or a square screen?
Yeah. It's a wide.
That's the problem.
That's going to be the issue.
Yeah, Windows 98 probably doesn't know about widescreens.
Yeah,
so
it takes
a square image and stretches it wide.
Right. So I was wondering if there was some way to teach it how to differently.
Get a new video card. And hope it has Windows 98 drivers.
But 98 still isn't. I don't think you're going to find anybody writing drivers for an operating system that's been dead since officially dead as of June of last year.
On the box or in the manual somewhere, there will be something that called the native resolution or the true resolution, and it's probably something like 1600 by 1050.
Right.
And your video card has to support that resolution or the monitor won't look right.
Okay. So I'll probably have to save that for a new computer then.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but we really are at the point where Windows 98 is completely unsupported, and unless a company has been kind enough to write a driver for it, you're kind of done.
Well, something you can check, you know, go to Westinghouse's website and hope.
Hope. It can't hurt to check, certainly, but I'm not holding out a great lot of hope.
Yeah.
Didn't know Westinghouse made monitors. Well, right next to the washer and the vacuum cleaners and
the light bulbs.
And the light bulbs, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a gorgeous monitor, you know, and I really like it, you know. But I don't like, you know, playing this darn Microsoft game of every couple of years having to upgrade your operating system just because
I bet that 22-inch widescreen monitor from Westinghouse will work on a Mac. Yep. And I know it'll work on a Linux box.
Yep.
That's what I was wondering.
Well, there's also the issue of the video card itself has to know how to support that high resolution, too.
Right.
On a Windows 98 box with an older video card, it may not.
Right.
So
right.
So there's two issues, the video card and the operating system.
And the driver, yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah, and I got online video, you know, with, you know.
Oh, yeah, onboard video.
Onboard
That'll almost never handle something like that.
Right. But you can try looking for a video card that supports that resolution that still has 98 drivers. Or switch to a Mac or load Linux in.
Okay. Is there a place where you can like try out the Linux operating system to see if you like it or not?
Absolutely. The Lugor user group. There's a group of people, the Linux user group of Rochester, or Lugor. You can read all about them at lugor.org. LUGOR, the Linux user group of Rochester. And they meet every month. Actually, they meet at RIT. Go there, talk to those folks. Let me tell you what, they would be thrilled and delighted to show you Linux and see what you make of it.
There's another one. You had the boot disk where you can boot.
Yeah, there's a couple of Linuxes you can download and play with without affecting your Windows installation.
It loads off the CD.
Right, and if you go to ubuntu.com, ubuntu.com.
Can you run it by me one more time? Which one was it?
Ubuntu, UBUNTU.
Okay, .com, right?
.com, and that takes you to the Ubuntu operating system. And you can download and burn a copy of that for absolutely free. And it is a bootable CD. It will run from the CD. Now, it's going to run very slowly because all that stuff on the CD is compressed. And the CD, of course, runs a lot slower than your hard drive to begin with. So don't pay attention to the speed, but the fact is that you'll be able to run all that stuff and see what you think and how you like it and how you feel about it. And as I always say, it's like buying a new car. You already know how to drive, you just don't know where the radio controls are. You know, you still know how to use a computer, you just have to figure out all the new menu items.
Gotcha. Well, thanks again for the non-existent GIF. I'm sure I'll find a use for it.
Well, your name has not gone down in history, so congratulations.
Talk to you guys later.
Thanks, Larry.
There's actually a bigger debate running now in the Mac, bigger than Mac versus Windows.
Wow.
Which Unix is best for beginners?
Linux?
Which Linux? And, you know, they're arguing in our forums. Arguing online.
PC Linux OS is good. Yep. Saboyan? Yep. I forget.
And how do you define Ubuntu? Good is the question.
Right. Ubuntu, of course, is an ancient African word, meaning I can't configure Debian. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, the mighty Dan Cole, me, Nick Francesco, and each and every one of you at 15 minutes after the hour at Soundbites on 1180 WHAM.
Wham's
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dan Cole.
At 18 minutes after the hour, you're listening to Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. Here's one of my favorite stories. It's not quite what I thought it was going to be when I read the title, but everything else is going wireless. Phones, internet, television, email, music sharing. Now, how about power? How about wireless power? Huh? Next week is the Consumer Electronics Show, which, by the way, Wham has not decided to send me to. Not that they were ever even thinking about it for a moment.
We were.
Yeah, right. There are two companies, an Arizona-based startup called Wild Charge and a Michigan-based company called Fulton Innovation. They will demonstrate what are expected to be very different ways to give gadgets juice without wires. The concept isn't actually new. In fact, Nikola Tesla did it in the early 1900s, and most of the same challenges such as cost and size have prevented the technology from winning over manufacturers. But the companies, who won't say how much their recharging devices will cost, hope the sheer amount of mobile gadgets today could portend a different outcome. Wild Charge's product called Wild Charger can recharge a variety of handheld gadgets at once, mobile phones, MP3 players, digital cameras, or a laptop, by placing them on a metallic pad. At CES, Wild Charge will debut a 90-watt device. Now, smartphones and MP3 players need 3 to 5 watts. Smaller laptops need 50 to 75 watts. So you could do a whole bunch of stuff all at once. It's a 6x15-inch pad, about a tenth of an inch thick. That gets plugged into a power source, but then you just set the thing on it and recharge it. Fulton Innovation's vision is similar, but the technology is different. Now, they're calling their technology e-coupled. Motorola, Mobility Electronics, Visteon, and others have signed up to back it as a wireless power standard. So there'll be a consumer version of an e-coupled product to CES, which is a car cup holder that recharges devices set inside it. How cool is that? So you're driving along, you drop your iPod into the cup holder. You have to take your cup out first. That would probably be best.
Yeah, I should say.
And that's it. You plug the car holder into the 12 volts, and you're done.
Nikola Tesla. That warm and cool.
Right. Now they got one that'll recharge your iPod. The Nikola Tesla actually did it a little differently. What I thought they were going to talk about is wireless power. Nikola Tesla never plugged anything in his labs. He just, you know, if he wanted a light source, he picked up a glowing light bulb and moved it to the other side because he was running power through the air.
Isn't it? Wait a minute.
But this is a little different. This is just a recharger. You drop it on the pad and walk away.
But don't a lot of cars nowadays so have adapters already so you can hook up your iPod?
Well, yeah, but that uses your engine power.
Well, this will too.
But wait a minute, though. But once it's plugged in, doesn't it also charge it?
Yes, it does. But the point here is you don't have to be carrying those plugs around, and you've got one plug for your cell phone and one plug for your iPod and one plug for your PDA and another. So instead of having to do all that and fumble around and whatever, just drop it on the pad and walk away, or just drop it on the pad and wait.
The military and even NASA have been playing with microwave power transmission for years for unmanned aerial vehicles.
Right.
You put an aerial observer over a battlefield and you beam power to it. It never has to land.
Right. Speaking of Westinghouse, who was one of the people backing Nikola Tesla, Tesla proved that beamed power was possible. You could power any device through a beam through the air. The problem Westinghouse had trouble with was figuring out how to charge people for it.
Yeah.
And that's why they stopped doing it. All right. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Linda from Greece, New York. Welcome, Linda. What's your question?
Hi, guys. How is everybody?
Peachy. How are you?
Fine. Okay. I've got a question. I don't know if it's for Steve or you, but I'll tell you. I've got iTunes on my computer. It's Windows XP. It's got Service Pack 2. You know, all the newest stuff. I bought a two-part series from the iTunes store. Okay. I can play it on my computer. But when I download it to my video iPad, I can only get part one. It will not give me part two, no matter what I do.
What happens when you try?
I sync the whole thing. It just doesn't show up. I have it syncing. It doesn't just, I mean, I can play it on my computer, but when I sync it, you know, and say, you know, take everything, it doesn't. It'll only take part one.
And you get an error message?
Nope. It just doesn't show up. I get nothing. It just doesn't show up.
Sometimes they get categorized in the wrong place. So if it's a TV show, it might show up under music videos, it might show up under movies. So maybe it's in a different category.
No, I have it in the library, and I made a folder. It's Knight Rider, okay? I made a folder for Knight Rider, you know, because I got music in my folders and everything.
Sure.
And everything. So the Knight Rider folder shows up on the iPad. It just shows up with just part one. No matter what I do, I can't get part two to show up. And I don't know what to do. I mean, you know, I want to play it on the video iPod. I can play it, but, you know, and I'm stumped. Any suggestions?
Have you updated to the latest iTunes 702?
Yep. And what I even did, I thought, well, maybe there's something wrong with my iPad. I even restored my iPad the other night, erased everything and downloaded everything, and it still doesn't show up.
Now, I've had a few instances where video won't transfer to my video iPod, but I get an error message telling me it won't transfer.
Nope.
It's weird that she can see it, you know, view it on her computer.
That means it downloaded okay. Have you watched it completely through on the computer?
Yeah.
And it finishes in the closing credits and the whole bit, so it's not a corrupted download.
Is it possible she doesn't have enough room left on her iPod?
You should get an error message.
I've got a 60-gig iPod, and I've only got 20 gigs used.
Linda, you know these are all the wrong answers, don't you?
Sorry. I went to another thing. iTunes, I'm finding it's very difficult to send questions to. I can never find out where to go to. The forum is okay, but I want to send them a question.
Yeah, you don't send iTunes a question. You'd go under the Apple forums and post a question.
Yeah, I know, but I've never gotten any answers. So I thought, well, it's coming Sunday. I'll ask you guys if you have an answer.
Sure. Hey, Steve's your man for that, but he's...
I'm searching the forums to see if anyone's had a similar problem.
You're truly not getting any error message. And when you connect your iPod, you saw it go across, right? I mean, there's a little thing at the top that says, you know, transferring whatever the file name is, and the little bar goes.
Well, there's almost, let me see, I don't know if there's a way to reset it. When you get an error message about transferring videos, there's a checkbox that says, don't warn me again. And then it doesn't warn you ever again that you won't transfer your video. So maybe the very first time there was an error message and you clicked don't warn me again.
Okay, so how do I...
How do you uncheck it?
Yeah, I'm wondering if there might be something in preferences to bring back those warnings again.
I don't know.
All right, Linda, we'll have Steve look this up, and either we'll get back to you about it before the end of the show, or we'll put it in the forums online.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Linda.
That's a weird one.
Clearly going to be a question that's going to take a little longer to research. Our next caller.
So I've run into problems with video I've ripped, and the message is this video can't be played because I didn't rip it at the right rate. But a TV show purchased from iTunes should
have no
problem.
Something you buy from iTunes ought to work. Yeah. All right. Our next caller is John from Penfield, New York. Welcome, John. What's your question?
Well, I've got a question about uninstalling IE7.
Mm-hmm.
After listening to your warnings about that, by the way, I was too late.
Yeah.
I decided to install Firefox, which I like very much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but I've got one website that I can't seem to load in Firefox, which I can load okay in IE7.
Yeah, a lot of lazy programmers often write code using Microsoft shortcuts that will not run in anything but IE.
But so I thought about it, and I said, well, maybe I should take your advice and uninstall IE7, and which would take me back to IE6.
But, right. See, the only reason we tell folks to go back to, not use IE7 is if they're running into other issues. Like, I've had a number of folks that everything was working fine, and, they installed IE7, and then a bunch of other programs stopped working. Like, one of the big issues is with QuickBooks. QuickBooks already tells you, if you're going to use QuickBooks, do not use Internet Explorer 7.0 to try to get down any of the updates or anything else, because it will corrupt your data.
Right. Well, here's my question. I went to uninstall IE7,
mm-hmm.
and I get this window
mm-hmm.
that tells me, with a whole list of programs, including Firefox, that may not work if I go ahead and uninstall IE7.
Yeah, that's all right.
Well, that's Microsoft being
overcautious.
I was going to say overly paranoid. They don't want you removing their product because they want you to use their product. They don't care that someone else's doesn't work.
Yeah. No, it's just going to take you back to that previous point in time.
So it's okay to ignore that and just do it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's what I was afraid maybe that they were right about something.
No. No.
I shouldn't have wondered.
There you go.
Okay, well, thank you, guys.
All right,
Jen. Thank you. Thank you.
He thought they were going to be right?
He thought they were going to be right. That's very funny. Mm. All right, our next caller is Ron from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Ron. What's your question?
Yeah, good morning. I'm running Windows XP. I have DSL and a wireless router.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I also have gotten Adaware SpyBot and AVG, and everything is updated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do I need Zone Alarm? Because from what I understand, DSL blocks a lot of the viruses and everything coming through.
Yes, you still want a firewall because...
DSL doesn't block anything. It's just an internet service.
Right, and DSL, though, doesn't provide any service from folks hacking into your computer. That's what a firewall will do.
You may have a firewall in your wireless router, but particularly on Windows, it's never a bad idea to run Zone Alarm. If your machine is fast enough... Add it in. It's kind of belt and suspenders, but it's a good idea when you're talking about viruses. We're going to take a quick break, but the great Brendan O'Riordan is in to
do the
news, the weather, the sports. He's finally come back from his yacht in the Caribbean, and he's here to do the news. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Mighty Dan Cole, me, Nick Francesco, and all of you at 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Sound Bites, and here comes Brendan O'Riordan with the news on 1180 WHAM. Take it away, Brendan! Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dan Cole.
Did you forget who you were for a moment there, Dan?
I was thinking about it.
All right.
Name kind of skipped.
At 32 minutes after the hour, you're listening to Sound Bites. Now, before we go back to the phones, three Intel quad-core processors are coming out tomorrow. Intel plans to launch three different quad-core processors tomorrow, covering two Xeons for lower-end servers and one mainstream model for desktop computers. The desktop chip is called the Core 2 Quad 6600 and will join the Core 2 Extreme QX 6700 model Intel already ships.
Can we get more confusing names?
Exactly.
Yeah, really.
Now, ever since Intel partnered with Apple, Apple's crazy names are leaking over to the Intel side.
Yeah, exactly. The desktop, this new chip will run at 2.4 gigahertz, a front side bus at 1.06 gigahertz. Front side bus, which means you're not going to drop that into your old laptop or desktop machine. Mm-mm. The two low-end Xeons are a 2.13 gigahertz and a 2.4 gigahertz machine. They're both designed for single processor servers. They have an 8 meg cache and, again, a 1.066 gigahertz front side bus. So we'll be seeing those in machines. Don't call up Dave and Steve asking for them on Monday, because you won't be seeing them in machines for a few months. But the basic idea is that there is a desktop version and a couple of low-end server versions. Nobody knows what the pricing is going to be yet. Nobody knows how long it'll be before desktop machines come out with them. But you'll end up with a quad-core processor. Now, the problem with all of this is it's unlikely you'll actually be able to make use of these under Windows.
The Macs, not many programs support more than two processors.
Up, but no place to go.
Right. Linux, you can do whatever you want. I have an 8-core server at work. I just dropped Linux on it. Oh, 8 cores. That's nice. We're happy.
Well, the Mac knows they're there, but not many programs.
Programs they don't use utilize.
Linux will use them. Windows will not. In fact, XP Home won't use more than two processors under any circumstances. And so it's going to be, you may not be using them in your current machine, but I suspect that Vista will. I don't know this, but I suspect that at least one of the there's 8 different versions of Vista. At least one of the higher-end ones will take advantage of this. And all you Linux people are laughing up your sleeves. Our next caller is...
I was going to say, there was some tests on... There were some tests on the quad Xeon that Apple ships.
Who's
with 4 cores in
one?
It. The old dual processor G5 that had two processors.
Thank you.
One of the big programs is Cinema 4D that is huge in Hollywood for rendering cinematic effects. Took 2.5 minutes to render a scene on the old G5. Took 30 seconds on the new Quad Xeon. So those people are anxiously awaiting the Octa Xeon.
Right.
Yeah, dual quads.
So you can do it something closer to real time.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Our next caller is John from Ontario. Welcome, John. What's your question?
Hi, guys. I've been having my computer's getting assaulted by what I think is a worm called Downloader.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it started showing up a couple of weeks ago. Maybe once a day I'd get a message from Norton saying it has found it and removed it. But as of yesterday and today, I'm getting like 30 of those little pop-up windows saying it found it and removed it. So right now I'm running Norton on safe mode. And I guess my question is, do you have any thoughts as to where this may be coming from?
Yeah, it said one ads. If you've got restore files turned on?
No.
You've got them shut off, so you're not doing any of the system restore files?
Nope.
Because that's normally where they like to hide.
Yeah, but if it's coming into you, you probably got your address in somebody's botnet. A botnet is a series of computers that are connected that have been overtaken by some worm, probably the downloader worm, and they're all in concert trying to break into other machines, and they all get the same list of names and addresses.
Mm-hmm.
And you're probably on that list, and therefore you're getting hit.
And you keep getting hit and getting hit and getting hit.
It's really there's tedious. Not much you can do about it except to just, well, you could turn off, I suppose, the notices in Norton. I mean, the reality is that the notices are kind of nice when you're getting one or two a day. When you're getting 30, 40 a day, turn off the notices. It'll still take care of them. The thing's not saying, should I delete it? It's saying, I did delete it.
Right.
Pat me on the back.
Yeah.
If you want to stop patting it on the back, just turn off the notices.
It's possible you could reset your cable or DSL router, turn it off for 20, 30 minutes, turn it back on again, and you might get a different address.
Assuming it's being done by IP address and not by email address.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm putting Ubuntu on a new box, so...
There you go.
Once I make the conversion, I may switch all of them over that way.
There you go.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thank you. Yep. Yeah, that's what a lot of people are doing now. They're taking an older machine, or at least another machine, and putting a version of Linux on it, and
playing with it.
Playing with it. All right, we're going to take another break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Dan Cole, me, Nick Francesco, and you. At 38 minutes after the hour, you're listening to Soundbites on 1180 WHAM.
You ever notice?
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I remember now, I'm Dan Cole.
There you go.
All right.
At 42 minutes after the hour, it's the hero discussion, but it's Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. We discuss things in today. It's been a discussion about heroes. We'll see that in the 22nd. I think it starts again.
Yeah, it starts back up on the 22nd.
All right, Mac OS X developers are closely watching the month of Apple bugs. Developers of applications for Apple's Mac OS X have been watching the month of Apple bugs project closely. We talked about the month of Apple bugs last week. They've done month of browser bugs, month of kernel bugs. Now it's a month of Apple bugs. They're generally in favor of the project's goal of uncovering flaws. But of course, as everybody else has, they have questions about the group's methods, which involve making their findings public immediately instead of first alerting Apple Computer. The stated goal of the month of Apple bugs is to uncover one bug a day for the month of January. To date, they've kept up their pace, revealing two vulnerabilities in QuickTime, one in iPhoto and another in a third-party application, the VLC Media Player. One of the QuickTime bugs was shown to leave open the possibility of an attacker executing code on a victim's system. In the long term, this project is making OS X more secure, but in the short term, these bugs can be used destructively before a patch comes out. They're saying that the consultants are all saying the correct way to handle the exploits would have been to inform Apple and give them something like 4 to 6 weeks to get a fix out. If nothing comes out of Apple at this point, then I'd publish the exploit. This way earns you credibility and respect. I can't necessarily disagree with that. Now, I do know that in terms of the browser bugs, one of the reasons they started doing that is because one of the major companies that makes a browser was ignoring their... they'd already sent all of those bugs to them, and they were being ignored.
Right.
And so that's why they put it out. I don't know if that's true in these other cases.
Well, one of the issues that's come up on the Apple side is Apple's browser Safari. And it's the trade-off between trying to make the internet easy to use for novices and hard for the bad guys. When you go to download a file, most people get confused about the whole downloading process. You have to download the file, you have to decompress the file, you get an installer that you then install. So you can end up with 4 or 5 copies of the thing before you actually get the thing you wanted in the first place.
Right.
So in Safari, there was a preference so that when you hit download, it would automatically download the file, automatically decompress it, and automatically run the installer, which was a good thing for novices. But a very bad thing for everybody else.
Right. And a very bad thing for novices if they clicked on the wrong thing.
Right. So now the browser warns you, this is an application, are you sure you want to download it? And if you didn't think you were downloading an application, that's a good idea to check no.
Right.
And you can turn off that option in the preferences so it doesn't automatically do that for you.
Right. Well, that's nice. All right. But that's the month of browser bugs. We already had a link to that on our website. Our next caller is Dave from Canandaigua, New York. Welcome, Dave. What's your question?
Well, I guess I have one sort of question about, I got SUSE Linux 10.2.
Yeah, sure.
And as much as everyone raves about Linux, I could do a whole show complaining about what's wrong with it. But nevertheless, my specific problem is that I've got Samba loaded up, both the server and the client.
Right.
Or so I think. When I try on the command line to try and mount Samba, I get a message that says this kernel doesn't support it. Now, when I use I'm using KDE. When I use KDE and I try and open up a file on my Windows box, on my Linux box, trying to open up a file on a Windows machine.
Right.
Okay, I'll get some kind of a link in order to get me over there.
Yeah.
But when I run something like OpenOffice, I have no way to get to my Windows machine.
Yeah, that's an interesting problem.
It sucks.
It does suck. OpenOffice doesn't quite yet understand either KDE or GNOME, which is how you're opening things. One of the things that I've done is I'll have two windows open. One is a link to that, to those files, that folder, and the other is OpenOffice, and I'll drag and drop. That works.
Oh, really?
At least it works for me under GNOME, but one of the problems is that it's what it sounds like is when it says this kernel doesn't support Samba, how did you load that Samba? Because SUSE comes with its own little program to install new stuff, and you should have been able to choose Samba if it didn't already come with Samba. In fact, Samba is one of the choices you can make when you install it, and then you wouldn't need to reinstall it.
Well, you know, I've been online and I've gone to all these different sites and they tell you do this, do that, and nothing I've done works. I can't. There sometimes if I get where I put a link in a directory and I go to that directory, when I click on it, Office just opens it up as a document for me to edit the text.
Right.
You know, what I see is the URL in there, and that's I'm trying to actually get the directory to come up. That's a showstopper. I'm actually trying to implement something for some users who have no real knowledge. It's already got a Windows box that the business runs on, and I'm trying to slowly migrate to Linux. But
right.
I, you know,
why don't you email me offline?
All right,
And we'll talk about this. This is going to be a longer response, I think, than the show has time for. But email me offline, and we'll figure this out together.
Okay, appreciate it.
Sure.
All right,
and that's. That's sort of what we were mentioning a little earlier, all the different flavors of Unix and the different flavors of Linux and the different kernels and the different builds. It's trickier to keep everything synced.
Right. And Sled is a nice product, but we'll have to see if that's what he was, SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop. We're going to take a quick break, back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Dan, I think I'm Dan Cole, and me, Nick Francesco, at 48 minutes after the hour at Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dan Cole.
At 52 minutes after the hour, it's Soundbites. All right, kiddies. Sit back. Relax. Get your footy jammies on.
We gotta
grab
get
that
some
cup
new
of hot
music.
Choke, cocoa. Grab your teddy bears. And sit in a circle on the floor. Around the old rocking chair. Because if we can get them awake and give him a quick shot of adrenaline, it's time for Story Hour with Uncle Dave. And here he is, Uncle Dave.
All right, Dan! Now there's what I'm talking about. You're still my hero. You're still my hero, dude. Boy, talk about being stretched to the limit this week. You know, I know the holidays are over. And I thought only loonies came out on the full moon.
No, they come from Canada.
No, loony? Not the money.
Loonies and toonies.
Not the money.
Yeah, loonies and toonies. Very good. Very good. No, I'm talking about, You know, right now all these stores are having these great, so supposedly great deals on systems. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, save you all the trouble of calling or being insulted or offended when I tell you, and this is politely the way I told one person, no way in hell. When they sit there and bring in a quote.
He means that lovingly.
When they bring in a system, you know, from one of these ads and say, well, can you build the system like this for the same price? And I tell them, no way in hell.
We don't build anything that crappy.
Yeah, I won't. I says, yes, I can, but no, I won't. And, but here's the other frustrating part. These folks are being told, well, yeah, and it'll be able to do the new Windows Vista because you're getting a coupon here to that'll offer it to you once it comes out. But what they're not telling you, folks, is, oh, by the way, the system that you just bought
is already underpowered.
Yeah, it's only got 256 meg of memory.
If you're lucky, some of them, I still see XP machines coming with 128.
Oh, yeah, no. But right now, they've upped it, Steve. You can now get 256.
It's a free upgrade.
Yeah, with the free upgrade to Windows Vista. Oh, it's using onboard video, which is also taking part of that 256 memory. Very, you know, and hard drive, everything is very low end. So when it comes to putting Vista on and say you bring it to me and then I tell you, oh, no, you've got to upgrade the video card. You've got to upgrade the memory. Don't get porked off at me because you got this great deal because I wouldn't match what they were doing.
It's not enough to run XP well and don't even bother putting Vista on.
And then they want
it.
To do Vista and they say, well, it's going to be able to run Vista. Well, any of my machines can too. But you'll be able to just do Vista, not have to do any more additional upgrades. That's what they're not telling you. The rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say, you're going to have to get at least a gig. 2 gig of memory is going to be better. I would recommend 256 meg of memory as far as video, at least 120 or greater hard drive size.
And that's almost the smallest you can buy these days.
Well, I can still get 80s. I still use 80s. That's about the smallest ideal right now. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I had a client say, what, you don't have any 20s?
Yeah. Go, huh? Yes, well, don't have any 20s.
Well, yeah, we have people like to, I don't need 80 gigs. Well, I'm sorry, that's the smallest we can find.
Yeah, same here. Well, I know.
Or you go to the 2.5-inch models for laptop models, and you can get a 40 gig, and it costs as much as the 80 gig for a desktop.
Or sometimes more.
Sometimes more.
So, you know, right now, folks, don't bother. Like I said, I'm not going. You know, I'm not trying to be mean or cruel or anything else, but it's a fact of life.
Yeah, the $299 Walmart computer is worth $299. Don't bother.
You're going to get what you got, and I will not compromise in the parts that I use in my machines. Because, you know, like I tell folks, the only time I want to see you back into the shop is when, you want to buy another machine, or you want me to do some additional upgrades.
Yeah, they're disposable. It's $299. Something breaks, throw it away, buy a new one.
Yeah, and I'm sure you're the same way, Steve. You want your customers to be happy. You don't want them constantly being on the phone. Mr. Enright, this isn't working right. You know, you want them to be able to enjoy the computer.
It's working exactly as expected.
Yes, and the only time you bring it back in is either, you know, because you wanted to add this on. I had one person all of a sudden just bring a machine I sold just 6 months ago and said, you know what, you were right. I go, refresh my memory. Oh, you told me I probably want that card reader. Well, I just got a camera, and can you still put that card reader in? Yeah. And we put this nice faceplate in, that it's a 42-in-1 card reader. It can put the different media in. It's got an additional USB port. Hooked it all up for them. Yep. They said, oh, okay, thank you very much. And away they went. Those are the type of folks I want to deal with. Not sell you a cheap system, and you're constantly bringing it in, well, this isn't working, or this ain't working. No, I don't need the headaches. Don't want them. So, you know, take your big specials. If you want to get them, go ahead and do it.
We had some related issues the Saturday before Christmas and the Saturday before New Year's. A lot of people are off work, and they brought their computers in for service.
Right.
Bring them in on Saturday. They'll call Tuesday morning. Is it done yet?
No.
Right.
Just because you're on vacation doesn't mean I'm not, too.
Nick, I had another story related. We've talked about this many a times. How the guy saved money.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all right. I had one like that, too.
Yep.
Sat there, didn't want to buy from me because he could get a better deal at this big company.
Yep.
But then when it came to support, he calls me up, and I says, what can I help you with? Well, this isn't working right. Oh, wait a minute, because I couldn't remember. Where'd you get the system? Well, I bought it from the big name place. Well, why don't you call them? Well, it takes too long, and I can't understand them. Well, that's not my problem.
Yep.
You want to bring it in, and I'll fix it. Yeah. But it's under warranty. Yep. That's not with me.
Right.
You want it fixed, bring it in, we'll fix it.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Brendan O'Riordan is back. He's going to be bringing you news, views, all the weather and sports and all the stuff you really listen to Wham for.
Sure, and on the other twin side, brother.
And on the other side of that, we should be having Tommy Gardner, who's the Director of Sales and Marketing for Remote Backup Systems, to talk to us. We will be back ourselves in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with Mighty Dan Cole, with me, Nick Francesco, and all of you. If you're on the line, stay on the line. We will be getting to you. If you're not on the line, I don't know why you're not, because you are listening to Sound Bites. And at 59 minutes after the hour, we'll be back on the other side of the news on 1180 WHAM.
Now.
The 1,000-watt News Radio 1180 WHAM proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show at 222-1180, star 1180, a free call for Verizon Wireless subscribers, or the One Communications line at 1-800-295-1180. Now alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on 50,000-watt 1180 WHAM.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dan Cole.
And at 6 minutes after the hour, you're listening to Soundbites. Now, every week here on Soundbites, we do a poll. This week's poll is all about our guest of the week. The poll is about how often you back up. The choices are once a day, once a week, once a month, once I'm reminded, once, and back up, I'm going commando, which we all think is a terribly, terribly bad idea. Our guest this week is Tommy Gardner, who's the Director of Sales and Marketing for a company called Remote Backup Systems at remote-backup.com, and he's here to talk about backing up and his products and everything else. Welcome, Tommy, to the show.
Hey, it's good to be here. Good morning from sunny, crime-free Memphis, Tennessee.
Tennessee!
How's the barbecue?
Sam McGee is from Tennessee, where the cotton blooms and blows.
Wonderful. Thank
What's
you.
The weather like down there?
Well, today it's a little overcast, but generally speaking, we've had the same unseasonably warm weather that most of the country is seeing, and we're hoping it's El Nino and not the global warming trend that everyone is thinking it may be. But hey, we'll see. Time will tell.
It's 43 degrees here in Rochester, and as far as we're concerned, that's a lovely spring day.
You guys are running around in shorts and headbands, right?
That's exactly right.
That's about
we're going
it.
Out sunbathing later. It's an ugly sight, but it's a necessary thing.
Yes,
so tell us a little bit about Remote Backup Systems and what you folks do.
Absolutely. We are a 20-year-old privately held software company, and it's really to tell easy to tell what we do because we do one thing and one thing only, and that is code, manufacture, distribute, and support online data backup software that is designed from the ground up for the online backup service provider. So we are not, it's important to get out there early, I think, with the fact that we are not a remote backup service provider, but we are the software that powers many of the prominent online data backup services out there today.
So I don't call you up to back up my home machine, but I do call you up if I want to run a business backing up people's home machines.
True. About 70% of our licensees use the software to brand it as their own, which is a native capability, and then to extend typically a monthly billed online data backup service to their clients. Now, the other 30% are people like banks, universities, hospitals, even the U.S. military, who use our software as a in-house client and server arrangement. In effect, functioning as their own service provider, keeping it in-house, if you will.
Right. And that, I got to tell you, I love that idea. I'm the systems administrator for the College of Business at the Rochester Institute of Technology. The E. Philip Saunders College of Business at the Rochester Institute of Technology. And we do backup for our faculty and staff as long as they put it on what's called their P drive, their private drive. That's a system we back up. But, of course, the problem is they've got laptops, they're off on the road, they don't connect, they write a file, they stick it on their hard drive, and the next thing you know, they've lost their machine and never backed up that file.
I hear that story all day, every day, I tell you.
I bet you do. I'm looking at your website, and it looks like you guys do pretty much everything in terms of supporting a company that's going to do this. Whether it's internal or you know, you've started your own small company to do this.
Yeah, it's true, and it's in use by an amazing array of companies and organizations around the world. At last count, we have approximately 8,000 licensees in 68 countries around the world, and again, about 70% of those are using it in some type of commercial fashion, usually offering services to others. The other 30% are using it as an in-house solution. But it does, you know, the nice thing about it is, unlike other products that you might be able to kind of shoehorn into a commercial application,
right,
ours does the things that answer the needs of commercial service providers. It's been built out over 20 years, 17 years as a for-sale commercial product, you know, directly in response to real providers with hundreds of clients, even thousands in many cases, who say, you know, this is great, we love the product, but now we need it to do X, Y, Z, and here's why. So as soon as the business case is clear to us, of course, we do the development work and make it happen. So this extends to functionality that is very much leading edge in our industry, such as native support for open, hot, and live Exchange and SQL databases.
Nice.
Which also offers mail folder level restores, which is a pretty critical differentiator from the entire database level restore that you'll find with other less robust products.
Right, because my mail is all fine, but Dave lost one email, wants a restore. Now all of a sudden I find I've got a bunch of junk there that I didn't know I had.
And already deleted.
Right, and already deleted, whereas your product will just restore him.
Exactly, and that's a big deal, because if you guys have ever been, and I'm sure you have,
it's a huge deal.
A situation where you had to bring back the entire 16 gig Exchange database and use Xmerge to bring back a certain user box, and it just, you know, that in itself, if you have to do things like that, you're already upside down on your monthly bill for the clients, you know, the revenue that they're getting.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty critical. You know, the native customization is something also that the VAR and reseller and service provider community really likes. Again, since we're not a remote backup service provider, we don't really have any vested interest in popping our logos and graphics up in front of our end users' clients. So everything from the icons, logos, splash screen, about screen, help files, the whole user interface from start to finish is designed to be positioned as your software, that's speaking it to the service provider. And that extends to the company name and the screen captions, customizable email notifications, and pretty much everything.
Nice. Now, for those of our listeners who are interested in this sort of thing, is this a Windows product, a Linux product, a Mac product? How does this work?
Right now, it is Windows on the server side. However, it's important to note that we do not interact with CALs and those Microsoft server OSs, so you don't have the added cost, if you will, of purchasing that CAL seat.
The licenses, right.
Right. On the client side, we have capabilities. Again, we're native to Windows, and this includes workstations, server OSs, whatever you have laying around. We can back up Macs and Linux data. In fact, we can back up any type of data that we can see via MapDrive or Samba from a Windows machine running our client. Therein lies, I think, potentially one of the most critical differentiators of our product is that, let's imagine the typical office, the small office scenario where you have a server and 10 workstations.
Right.
Everyone is saving to the P drive or to that, you know, the shared server drive.
Right.
The client can be installed on that server, and most of the data ostensibly backed up from that box. However, as the service provider is headed out the door, the CEO or the accountant might say, hey, you know what, I just remembered all the accounting data is on my PC in the corner office for, you know, privacy reasons. I don't share it to the server. What can we do? Well, the answer with our software is go into the client user interface, create a secondary backup job within that single client interface on that server and back up the data from the corner office as a second backup job within the single client instance.
Nice.
You could actually back up multiple computers within the same LAN using a single license. That, again, is designed to maximize the revenue of the service provider. We know that people who buy this are either in it to make money or in it to
save money.
And therefore, you shouldn't. Some of the client seats out there for products quite a bit less robust than ours are astronomically high in price.
Well, I noticed you guys start at like $600. Excuse me, $599.
That's right.
But I really thought that was a misprint when I first looked at it. I thought it can't possibly be that cheap because everybody else is way more expensive.
Usually what it'll sell it, though, is all you got to do is have a client lose important data because they didn't take the time to back it up. And like your software says, you can do it when there's downtime. Usually at night, you start the job, say, 8, 9 o'clock, and it finishes up before morning.
And for someone who's lost data, looking at a commercial data recovery service, a couple grand easy.
Yep.
Absolutely. Drive Savers out of California is a good example. They do good work, but I think their in-the-door price is about $1,500. And for a true forensic recovery, you're looking somewhere between $3,200 and $5,800. So the nice thing about it generally is that the software is approachable from a pricing standpoint. The prices that are on our website at remote-backup.com are one-time charges, so that if you buy a 250 client version of the software, you pay whatever the cost of that is. Next year, the only thing that you owe us from a company maintenance perspective is $399 per year. So it's inexpensive in year one, and it's downright negligible in terms of cost in second and subsequent years.
Right. If you've got enough people amortizing that across a number of your people, that's ludicrously cheap.
Absolutely, and for the functionality, again, we're doing things online that the Veritases and Brightstores of the world aren't even accomplishing very well on the LAN yet. So we like to think we're kind of leading the charge in leveraging the Internet for data backup.
And for those system administrators listening in, you're talking about this works everywhere. You don't have to be on the LAN. You can be on the Internet anywhere and back up.
True. The client software is typically configured to call out in a very secure way to a known IP address, which would be the destination backup server, or to a domain name assigned to it by our server locator service, which, among other things, is kind of a DDoS service.
Right.
So once that, you know, once that is programmed, if you will, into the client, it's really just a matter of filling in that pertinent information on the client software GUI. The client initiates the call. Typically contacts on one of the main data ports and then calls back and uses up to five ports to stream the data. But the nice thing about it is you can schedule it to run, as most people do, after hours each day, say, you know, 9 o'clock or whatever time you can count on users being, you know, network traffic being at a minimum, etc. Or for the road warriors out there with laptops, you can simply get to the hotel, establish your high-speed internet connection, open the client, and click backup now, and it'll simply kick off manually so that you can get it done when it makes most sense for you to do it.
Nice. Yeah.
Like you say, all it takes is, because what folks don't realize, like you were saying, though, with that Drive Saver, I'm taking it off, and it's going to cost quite a bit to do that. But the other thing that is, though, is while that drive is gone, you're down. Whereas if you've used your software to back it up, now I can get another hard drive back into this other machine and restore it within hours.
Absolutely. And that user-friendliness, I guess, extends perhaps most critically to server environments as well, along with the critical data and files. And while we're not typically doing a quote-unquote bare metal backup, we are backing up critical system elements like system state, Active Directory, all the linchpin pieces that you're going to need to quickly put somebody back in business. The statistics are very clear that if a business organization of any type goes without their main data stores for 10 days or more, according to the National Archives, they're out of business.
So
it's just, you know, if you can't help your customers, if you can't identify them, one of your competitors will be more than happy to step up and take that load off of you.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, listen, I got to pin you to the wall here. For those of our listeners who are in the healthcare industry, what about HIPAA?
The software complies with the final security rule of HIPAA.
You got me.
My background is actually in the management and remote handling of personally identifiable health information. So HIPAA and the NCQA HEDIS audits and that type of thing is very near and dear to my heart.
Well, near at least.
Right. Absolutely. The encryption key is created either statistically perfect methodology through our client software or by the client in a secretive way during the installation. It is then maintained only by the client. Nice. And that is typically, you know, burned onto a CD or saved to a thumb drive, some way that the client will be able to take that off-site and store it, you know, with perhaps in a bank safety deposit box or whatever, so that not only does the service provider not have access to their encryption key, he cannot even view, because the file names are encrypted when they're in storage on his server, he can't even tell you what the file name is for client data as it sits on his server. So unlike other, again, less robust and less mature products out there, our software never sends the encryption key back to the server. There are products out there that that simultaneously claim HIPAA compliance. Apparently they don't understand it.
Well, yeah. Well, that's a big problem with HIPAA, isn't it?
Right. It is. It's a mystery wrapped in a riddle for a lot of people.
That's
but,
good, though.
It does comply with the final security rule. You know, in my experience and that of our service providers who service, particularly the health payer community in the form of insurance companies and physicians within their networks, 95% of HIPAA manifests as client-side operational things, locked
right.
server room doors, password-protected databases.
Right.
And those are things, clearly, that no software product can stamp an approval on. But to the extent that is technically possible, our software is among, if not the most secure online backup software product out there.
Well, I'm very impressed. Tommy, I'm afraid we're about out of time. I really want to thank you
very much.
For those of you who are desperate, and you should be.
Yes.
If you don't have this kind of backup system, this full soup to nuts, does everything backup system, you should be desperate to get it. Head on over to remote-backup.com. Tommy Gardner, Director of Sales and Marketing for Remote Backup Systems, thank you so very, very much
Thanks
for being
again,
our
Tom.
Guest today.
Thank you, gentlemen. Have a great rest of the weekend.
You too. Keep smiling.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, we are going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Those of you who are on the line, we'll be getting to you shortly. I want to thank Tommy Gardner for joining us and being our guest. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Dan Cole, me, Nick Francesco, and you at 21 minutes after the hour at Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. Welcome, Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dan Cole.
At 25 minutes after the hour, it's Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. We've had people patiently waiting on the phone. Our next caller is, I think it was Patty?
Yeah, Patty.
Where are you calling from, Patty?
Ontario. I'm from Kendall.
Kendall, Patty from Kendall. What's your question?
Well, I have a question. We have a wireless home network set up, my husband and I. We have a desktop with Windows XP Pro and a laptop with the same operating system, and it seems to be working fine. We can access the internet, and my laptop can pull up, I have file sharing set up, my laptop can pull up files from my desktop, but my desktop can't see files on my laptop.
Your laptop is set up to share?
Yeah, sharing goes both ways. You have to turn sharing on both computers.
Yeah.
I did the same stuff that I did on my laptop, you know, that I did on my desktop.
Now, are they of the same work group?
And it shows up. I can see, when I go into Windows Explorer, I can see the laptop on there. It's just when I try to open it, it gives me a message that says, you know, the name of my notebook is not accessible. You might not have permission to use
it. Okay. Contact your admin.
Right. That's a different message. That means it can see the files, but you don't have access to them.
Right.
What username and password are you logging in as?
On the notebook or on the desktop?
Either.
Either.
See, they have to be this. You have to be on both.
Right, yes. You have to have the same username and password on both computers to make it easy.
And we do. Our user account name is the same, and so is our Windows password.
See, this is...
That should work, then.
Yeah, and this is a... I haven't been able to find... I'm going to be honest with you. There's something in the Windows XP security that is mucked up, and I still haven't been able to find out where. I've had other clients, I had one Friday. She came in and, you know, we went through the whole scenario, just what you're talking about, you know, everything was clicked and tied and checked and everything else, but yet the two couldn't see each other. And it's like, it doesn't make any sense. And it boils down to some setting in the Microsoft security that's sitting there saying, no, you don't have the rights to do that. And I just haven't been able to find out where that file.
If you go to properties on the folder you're trying to share, you can set the security level. One thing you can try doing temporarily is turn on guest. Then you can log in as a guest, which means you don't need a username and password.
Or, Patty, one other thing.
Hang on a second. The danger of guest is that means that anyone can log in without a username or password.
Yeah, but instead of before going to guest, if you go to start and search and do a search for that particular computer that you're trying to link to, it very well might find it. That's one of the workarounds that I found that will sometimes work for you.
Okay.
You do the search and it'll say files, or you can say search for a computer.
Okay.
And it'll try to find that computer on that network. And tell you what, this is one thing that's been bugging me for months. As soon as I find out how to correct this, because it's like a big Microsoft secret.
Yeah, the message comes up. I am the administrator. I have given permission.
Right.
And it still doesn't work.
I've noticed that when you do the files and settings transfer, that messes up settings in the network too, that it doesn't always bring things over clearly. And Microsoft, to this day, still keeps it a big dark secret of how to reset that.
I've also seen cases where the network browser doesn't work properly, but if you go to start, run, and do //, and then the IP address of the other computer, it will work.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Well, at least I know it's supposed to work. As long as I know it's supposed to work.
Yes, it's supposed to, Patty, but...
But you can do that. If you go to start, run... Type in // and the IP address of the other machine.
Okay.
That should open up a window on the root directory, and you should be able to see all the files.
Right. Well, first you get the login prompt.
Right.
And then you make sure your username and password is...
Correct.
That's the tricky thing we get all the time. It's asking for the username and password of the other computer that you're trying to connect into, not the computer that you're on.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is why making them all the same is the easiest.
Right. All right, good luck, Patty.
Thanks very much.
But this is one of those little Microsoft things. Our next caller is Virginia in Batavia, New York. Welcome, Virginia. What's your question?
Hi, good afternoon. It's nice being back with you this new year.
It is. Welcome back.
I'm doing an exercise in problem solving, and it's not my system. I'm having trouble with the printer and the computer communicating.
Okay.
I can't. Nothing will print. It's a Compact Me laptop, and the printer's a Canon BJC55. I did try and uninstall the printer.
Mm-hmm.
Then I ended up with a second copy of the printer when I installed it again, so I think I finally have it completely uninstalled. Then I went to the Canon website, to their troubleshooting page, and they gave me two things to check on. One is the, it says error writing to LPT1.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then the other one, is printer not responding, this document failed to print. Now, I haven't gone through this, but is there any little tricks or hints you could?
Well, there's a couple of things. First, which operating system are you running?
Me.
I'm
containing myself.
It's not my computer.
I know.
Part of the question is, does Compaq have a driver for ME? If they don't, you can't use a different driver.
The printer was working. Oh, we had it working.
All right. Then you've got one of three likely problems. Nobody expects Spanish Inquisition. It's either if it's not the printer driver, then it's either the cable, the printer itself, right, or the connector. So first make sure that everything is connected in tight.
Yep.
Okay.
Next, can you run the self-test? And there should be something in the manual that shows you how to run a self-test.
I've been noticing a lot of the basic inkjet printers don't have self-tests in them anymore.
Or you can print a test page.
Because there's no processor.
Page. Usually you can print a test page.
I think that someplace it did tell how to do a test page.
Yeah.
Yeah, run a test page and see if that works.
Well, if she right-clicks at, if she's installed it and right-clicks on it and goes properties, it opens up a window. And the very first screen in the lower right-hand corner is print test page. See if you can print that. It'll tell you whether it's having trouble communicating to it. The other thing I would say is it was working before. Instead of trying to use the new driver, use the original drivers that came with that printer, since it is working with Windows ME. Try putting it on with the original CD.
Okay.
I mean, the new one might be too new because they're also trying to adapt it to other Windows operating systems like XP and the rest, that it might be causing too many problems because of your Windows ME.
The other question is, if it did work and now it doesn't, what changed? Did it get moved? Did you put in a different cable or a longer cable? Did you move the whole system to another part of the room?
Is this a parallel printer or a USB printer?
Parallel.
Well, she said LPT-1. That could be an issue. Is it a USB printer trying to go to LPT-1?
Right. Virginia?
Yes.
Is this connected via parallel port or USB port?
USB, I believe. It's a parallel.
Parallel port is the big, wide 25-pin connector.
No, not that way.
USB is the little tiny one, about half an inch.
Yeah.
Why? Okay. So that's part of your problem.
Yeah.
Your computer is trying to go to LPT-1, which is the parallel port.
You got to go to USB.
Right. The printer is not plugged into the parallel port, so the error message is correct.
I bet your friend installed... Yeah, right, because it's never me. It's not my machine. It's a friend's machine. Yeah. We all say that.
Yeah.
Your friend installed some piece of software like, for example, any one of 1,000 card printing programs or whatever that actually changed the port. So one of the things you might try is going into the control panel into printers and see where that computer thinks it's connected. It should not now be connected to a parallel port. It should be connected to the USB port.
To a USB port. Okay.
Yeah.
And that, you're right, that's a very good catch, Steve. That is likely her problem.
Yeah, it is. That would be it, because if it's trying to print to a parallel port and it's USB, you just got to go into, right-click on it, go properties. The second tab, I think it's the second or third tab, is ports. And you click on the port, and if it says it's LPT-1, you got to scroll down that list to where you see, and it'll usually recognize it. You'll see it on there.
USB,
it'll say the printer after that. And just check that one instead.
All right, Virginia, I hope your computer, excuse me, your friend's computer.
My friend's computer, okay.
Is fixed. Thanks. All right, we're going to take a quick break.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray. It's Dan Cole. I'm sorry, Dan. I was looking over here. I apologize. I'll never make that mistake again.
Yeah, after Rob forgot the donuts last week, I was waiting downstairs for him to show up today to let me in the building, and he never did.
And he never did. He is persona non grata, and we have the great Dan Cole in instead. It is 35 minutes after the hour. You're listening to Soundbites on 1180 WHAM.
Wham!
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Rob Dan Cole.
At 39 minutes after the hour, you're listening to, I don't know, I'm not sure, but it might be Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. Back to the phones. We've had people who've been waiting for so long. Bert from Palmyra is on the line. Welcome, Bert. What's your question?
Hey, great show. Great guest, guys.
Thank you.
Really mundane, stupid, simple
problem.
Before
you get there, he was good, wasn't he?
He was.
I mean, he had lots of information. It was good information. He was an interesting guest. I was very pleased that he came on.
Yep, would have made be great in another seat on your show each week.
Yeah, it would, but he's down in Tennessee, and
yeah.
Unfortunately, he won't come here. I'd be happy to go there.
Yeah.
All right, what's your question?
Like I said, it's kind of a stupid one, just a nuisance thing. Thunderbird, reading news groups on Usenet.
Yeah,
it's messing up really bad.
Yep.
I've been reading on the forums, can't find the specific problem. It's miscounting postings and on and on and on. Do you have any information?
Well, it may not be Thunderbird.
Mm.
One of the problems with Usenet is that that happens.
Let's define Usenet for the younger folk.
Yeah.
Right. Back before
there was an internet.
Yeah, right. Back before there was an internet, there was a thing called Usenet where people would post stuff and it would eventually wander, and it would take days, and it would wander its way around the network, and you had to have a Usenet server to download Usenet groups from.
It's a giant bulletin board at the local, you know, market.
Right. It's a giant bulletin board. The problem has always been that some systems miss files. There used to be programs you could get that would connect to 3 or 4 or 6 or 10 different servers. And that way, and it was smart enough to grab pieces and parts from all of them so that you ended up with a full set. Mm-hmm. But that simply doesn't happen so much anymore because so few people now use Usenet compared to the number
really
on the internet.
Usenet's gotten really fast, and the noise has dropped down quite a bit.
Yeah, actually, Usenet has become useful again.
Yeah, because everybody's gone.
Who was it said, it's very clear that an infinite number of monkeys cannot reproduce Shakespeare because we've proved that with Usenet.
Yeah.
But yeah, it really, I don't know, and I don't necessarily need to know what your Usenet server is, but the reality is that a lot of them don't get the full stuff anymore.
Hmm. Yeah, this happened kind of suddenly. I'm on Roadrunner. They did make some changes, the Rochester RR.com,
right.
And it happened right after they absorbed a couple other companies.
Yep.
So, yeah, got a Google groups it, I guess, now, huh?
Well, Deja News was the big one for a long time on the web, and then Google bought them.
Right. But there are news readers out on the web, www.newsreaders.com. If you're looking for Windows clients, it's newsreaders.com/win/clients.html. Steve will put that up on the board. But there's a bunch of standalone products. Barca, News Rover, Agent is one of the most famous ones. Free Agent is a news reader. And it is, as it says, free. There's All News, Dialogue, Gemini. I mean, there's a bunch of them. But the reality is that it may not be the reader, and it may very, very likely be the fact that that's Usenet. Miss stuff.
Yeah.
It's always part 27 of 140, too.
Yeah. Right. I'm sorry. What'd you say?
Just thanking you.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much. I'm sorry we don't have a better answer for you, but yeah, it's go to Google Groups now, I guess.
Yeah.
Pretty much the way to do that. Thanks.
Have a good one.
You too.
Our next caller, Craig from Greece, New York. Welcome, Craig. What's your question?
Well, I was recently given a ThinkPad.
Wow.
Well, it's an old one. It's a T21.
Okay.
850 megahertz processor. And in it right now is 256 meg of RAM of PC100.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to boost it up to 512. Yeah. And I've been going out on the web getting prices. And I see that PC-133 is like half the price of PC-100. I was wondering, is that stuff downward compatible?
Most of the time, but not always.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, you're going to have to read the specs on that particular machine because you can buy it and put it in, and then the machine won't boot.
Check the return policy. The other problem, too, is that sometimes older machines have 128 meg max or a 256 meg max.
No, I've read up on this. This has 512 max. It'll take two 256 megabyte sticks in it.
Then I'd stick with the PC 100s.
Okay.
Yeah, stick with that. That way you know you're not going to run into any issues trying to overclock that older machine or worrying about it to step down. Just stick with what it's got and, you know, get it up there.
The issue has become that they're not making that much of that old RAM anymore, so the prices are getting higher.
I realize that.
I've actually seen, we'll buy some PC-100 RAM, and you peel the PC-100 sticker off, and there's a 133 sticker underneath.
Yeah.
They just sold it at 100 speed.
Right, but it does, the ThinkPad T21 does use PC-100, and it has a max of 512 meg.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Talk about memory. I had a client that wanted to upgrade.
You should be the last guy to talk about memory. Oh, I see what you're saying. Go ahead.
Wanted to upgrade the memory in a machine. You want to talk about expensive memory?
Mm-hmm.
Try RIM memory.
RIMs, yeah.
Yeah.
It was going to cost them, just to upgrade the machine a little bit, over $700 to add additional RIM memory.
Wow.
And I said, well, wait a minute. For that memory that you're going to get, and it's only going to boost it a little bit, you're not going to gain that much because, again, like we've always said, you're just moving the congestion to another point.
If you only have 128 or 256, going to 512 will give you a nice speed boost. But if you're already at 512, going to 768 may not.
You're working with a Celeron processor.
Yep.
Right.
You know, you're not going. You're just moving the bottleneck somewhere else.
And then at the other end, the fully buffered DIMMs that Apple's now using in their high-end Xeon workstation have their own heat sink on them, their own processors on them. 16 gigs of RAM, if you want to max out the model, Apple will charge you $6,000.
Yeah. Well, the reality is, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch.
No. Nope.
Yep.
If you want speed and power and all the room on Earth, it's going to cost you money. Get over it.
Yep.
Price of poker keeps going up, and we just raised the ante again.
Yep. See, the irony that we always play with when a new model comes out is max out the specs on the store. The computer is $2,500.
Right.
The RAM is $6,000.
Right. Oh, yeah, that. But if you need it, it's cheap.
Then the twin 30-inch monitors are only $4,000.
Each.
No, $2,000 each.
Oh,
so $4,000 for both of them, yeah.
Well, I think it's Sony that just announced they're coming out, Steve, you'll love this, terabyte hard drive.
Yeah, several companies. Did you have that in your news?
I did, but I didn't.
We'll not get to it yet.
No, go ahead, talk about it.
Several companies are working on 1 terabyte drives. Right now, the largest single drive you can get is 750 gigs, three quarters of a terabyte. And then, so Western Digital, Seagate, Maxtor, they're all working on trying to race to be the first company to come out with a single drive that holds 1 terabyte.
Right.
I remember the early days getting a 10 megabyte drive and paying $5,000 for it.
Right.
In fact, was it last year? Was the 50th anniversary of the hard drive?
Yep.
IBM invented the hard drive. You know, like a 1 meg drive was $50,000.
Yeah.
And 1 meg was a huge amount of space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A million characters. Wow.
Yeah. Both Hitachi is also the one terabyte drive. SanDisk has just released a 32 gig flash drive.
Flash drives. We're going to start seeing those in laptops now because they don't draw that much power.
Right.
There have been a couple of companies, we sell a lot of LaCie drives, and in fact, Nick has talked about the network drive he bought. They sell...
I love that drive.
They also sell what they call their big disk. They'll put two 250s in a single box, and it shows up as a 500. Or they'll put two 500s, and it shows up on your computer as a 1 gig. It's not quite a RAID, but sort of. It's a quasi-RAID. And so you can get a 1 gig drive cheaper than buying a 1 gig drive.
Yeah, right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, Dan Cole, and me, Nick Francesco. All of you at 48 minutes after the hour on Soundbites on 1180 WHAM. Just a couple of weeks. We're counting down the minutes now. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Dan Cole.
And at 52 minutes after the hour, it's Soundbites. Just before we get back to the phones, I have to say that Seagate has announced that within 3 years, they will have a 300 terabyte 3.5-inch hard drive. 300 terabytes. That will store the entire Library of Congress without compression or half of Steve's porn collection.
Dave liked that one.
Well, half of Steve's porn collection today. Within 3 years, of course, and he'll need two of those drives, but that's okay.
Oh.
Our next caller is Paul from Holly, New York. Welcome, Paul.
You gotta warn me.
I do not. You should know they're coming. It's swallow, then breathe, Dave. I don't know if you knew that's the order those things are done in. Paul, are you there?
I'm here, Nick. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're doing good.
Okay. What's your question?
I may have an answer for Patty from Kendall.
Excellent.
I had the same problem with my home network, and if she's running the firewall, she may have to go into the firewall and type in the... IP address for that other computer.
Right.
Oh, good.
Allow
point.
File sharing to go through the firewall.
Excellent point. She may have, if she's running Windows Firewall, it may be disallowing.
Yeah, so she'll have to do an IP config on the computer and find out what the address is and then...
Accept it on the other end.
Accept it on the other end. I had the same exact problem.
Excellent
Very
thought.
Good point.
Thank you, Paul. With the new Windows Firewall, it does... You're right. You're absolutely right. Patty, I'm sure you're still listening.
Okay.
So that should give you an idea of what to do next. Thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate that. I love it when our users call in to answer questions. We really should just hook them all up and we just become phone operators. Our next caller is Rick from Churchville, New York. Welcome, Rick. What's your question?
my question is, I've got, I work with a bunch of computer geeks.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
He's going to upgrade his home system, and he wants to sell it to me. I just want to make sure I'm not going to get taken advantage of. Is there any place I can take it to get it checked, or is it just worth the safe thing knowing that I know the guy?
Well, you can almost bet that there's some sort of spyware and infection in it, yeah. If it's running Windows.
We do we do a diagnostics for 3240 that includes attacks, that we look the machine over and tell you what's wrong with it. If you decide to go with the repair,
if
it needs any, is that money that you pay up front is taken off the bill. And
yeah, one of the problems, though, is that you can run diagnostics and a computer can be working absolutely fine, and then an hour later the hard drive fails.
What's wrong?
Well, right.
Yeah.
What's wrong?
All
with
anybody
machine?
Can prove is that
it's working
right
now. Yeah.
Yeah. What's going wrong? That's questionable.
Oh, I'm just upgrading my system. I've got an old 800 megahertz computer that's 5-6 years old.
Yeah.
And the one that I'm getting from him would be a 3.4 with 1 gig RAM.
That's a pretty new machine.
Yeah.
I would suspect, take it to Dave, and for under $35, he can at least tell you whether or not all the hardware works. And that's really what you're looking for right now. You'll have to, obviously, since it's a Windows machine, you'll have to wipe the hard drive and install your own version of Windows and all that stuff. So none of that matters. But the hardware itself, Dave can at least tell you if it's all running.
Super.
There you go. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's actually a very nice service, because we're going to see, I'm sure, a lot more of that as time goes on.
Yeah.
Our next caller is Rick from Batavia, New York. Welcome, Rick. What's your question?
Hey, guys. Great show.
Thank you.
I'm expecting you're going to tell me I'm up the creek.
You're up the creek, Rick. Thanks for calling. Next.
Next. I have been transporting my, trying to take my hard drive out, put it in a new system. I have a Windows XP upgrade original disk. Mm-hmm. I had put the disk in a hard case as opposed to the flimsy sleeve that it comes in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And of course, the key is on the flimsy sleeve, and it is gone.
Oh, you be done. You can call Microsoft, and plead your case.
But
nobody's going to guarantee that's going
to
work.
Or what you can do is when you go to do the install,
right?
You can do register on the phone. And what it's going to do is generate a code. You're going to have to call that 800 number, give him the code.
He doesn't have the code.
It will no because he's not. It doesn't have it. It'll to go to register. It'll give you a number there, an 800 number.
There's a temporary code. Type this in.
And, oh, I see.
You call them on the phone, and they give you the responding code. Right. Now that's why I like a lot of the. In fact, pretty much all the new PCs now will sticker the Windows serial number to the box itself.
Goes on the side of the machine.
Yeah,
that's the way it's been for the past couple of years.
I see.
But there's your deal.
Give it a
shot.
Okay.
But most likely, I'm out $99 for a new version.
You may be.
You might be, but.
Yeah, try it.
Yeah.
It's a couple of minutes of your time.
Yeah, but okay. Are you saying on a landline, just call up to register or call?
Well, if you try to register over the internet, it will probably say something like it's already registered and you can't. You'll have to call them.
I don't have an operating system.
You're missing the disk too?
He has the disk, but he has no serial number at all.
I'm in the middle.
That's what I've been telling him. There's no serial number.
So you can't even start installing it.
So there was no
operating
system on it to begin with?
No, you weren't listening. He's got the disk.
Yeah.
But
it had an operating system. I put the hard drive in a new computer, so none of the registry things work. So it's asking, I have to do a refresh of the Windows XP.
Right.
I have the disk, and
it got
partway into that, and now I can't. When I tried
it asked for a serial number, but he lost the serial number.
All right, here's the thing, though. Wait a minute. Let's step back.
Okay.
In other words, you had an operating system on a hard drive. You're putting it in another machine.
Yes.
All right, so it's got an operating system on it, XP.
Yes.
Because you're going to new hardware, it wants a registration number.
Yes.
All right, here's what you do. This is doing an install of Windows over Windows.
I know, and that's what I'm trying to do.
All right, here's what you do, though. When you first go to the first screen...
Right.
It'll say install, and then you'll have to hit F8 to do the agreement.
I did that.
All right. Now, when you go to the next screen, there's an install or repair. You clicked the repair.
Mm-hmm. I did, and it's still asking me for the product key.
Because it's on a new system. It thinks it's a new system because he changed the motherboard and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, you're going to have to call Microsoft on the phone.
Yep.
Yep.
You're going to have to call their 800 number. I'm sorry. All right, we are done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. I want to apologize to everyone to whom we did not get. I'm afraid you're going to have to call earlier next week. We are done for another week. I particularly want to thank our guest, Tommy Gardner, from Remote Backup Systems. He was great. And we will be back here next week. Same bat time, same bat channel with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray. I don't know if we'll have the mighty Dan Cole or the sitting at home with his feet up on the desk, Rob Linton. I don't know who we're going to get, but it'll be one of us. It is 59 minutes after the hour. You've been listening to Soundbites on 1180 WHAM.